Pitch Talks, brought to you by North Star Bets. That's a win.
Come on in, sit right down and join us. It's another episode of Pitch Talks, not where we expected, not where we hoped to be last week when we did a thorough, deep dive Blue Jays playoff preview, all for exactly 18 innings of baseball and a loss. Nick, the Blue Jays season is already over. The playoffs here and gone in a flash. It is time to dissect the body here and take a look at what happened.
Yeah, I mean, it's surprising. It's not shocking. That's just the nature of a three-game series. Anything can happen, right? When you look at the even the five-game series, you look at the preview, heavy favorites, and I'm just going to go on FanGraphs playoff probabilities, will be at something like 60%. So the Blue Jays were heavy favorite-ish in a shorter series, which means that number was maybe more in the 50s, something like that. So the idea that they have lost this series should not be as gut-wrenching potentially as it feels to a lot of people right now. And that's because of the how, right? You know, the first game was a big Luis Castillo game. In many ways, it seemed like there was kind of nothing that they could do. And then the second game is the one we're going to drill down on, because that is the one that is going to go down in history. It's going to go down in Blue Jays history. It's going to go down in Toronto sports history. It was truly a collapse for the ages, and something that just, you know, it was a runaway train. There was all these little moments that added up to this thing that if they had caught a break at any of these times, they would have kind of stemmed the tide and it would have been like, wow, that was a little bit scary. They let that become a ball game. But instead it was, wow, they let that become the end of their season.
It will go down in Toronto sports history and unfortunately fit right in. It'll have no lack of companionship. Absolutely. I agree with you right off the top there. Is game two is obviously going to be the one that people really drill into. You can have your quick snap. You know, they should have scored a single run in game one. Be that as it may, Luis Castillo was just that good. But yeah, you score 9 runs in a playoff game, you expect to win. And it looked for a while there that was going to be the case. There is a ton to dig into. Again, to borrow some parlance before that game was played, the only way to eat this elephant is one bite at a time here, Nick. Where should we start? Where do you even start with a loss like this, with a situation like this? Because I think people, myself included, in processing this over the last few days, there's been 4 or 5 different things you could be mad at. Whether it's team construction or team performance or managerial decisions or offseason outlook, with a little bit of day's grace here and a few days of reflection, where do you start when you look back at what happened here?
It has to start with the bullpen. And we'll talk about the Kevin Gausman decision, that pull by John Schneider, because that definitely played a role in the outcome of this game. And I would venture that it was the wrong decision, as easy as it is to say that with the results in mind. But when you have an 8-1 lead more than half of the way through a ball game, and you have literally every single reliever available to you, and you could turn to your presumed game 3 starter, Ross Stripling, and you could turn to your $120 million man, Jose Berríos, I'm not saying that that would have been the right call, but I'm just saying that every single tool in John Schneider's tool shed was available to them, and still they could not get it done. And really, of all the pitchers they brought in, the one guy who looked decent was Jimmy Garcia. And beyond that, every other pitcher ran into struggles. Now, you could talk about Jordan Romano had some bad luck. He got the strikeouts and the bloop or whatever. He was pushed beyond his comfort zone. You could make excuses for him if you're inclined to do so. But the reality is that all season long, we talked about, is this bullpen good enough? It seems like they kind of have one shutdown guy and a bunch of competent guys as opposed to the, you know, the multiple relief ace model that we've seen, as you know, kind of goes back to the 2015 Kansas City Royals. And we've seen that with a lot of teams have had playoff success. They don't just have the one guy, the closer, the shutdown dude. They have guys, you know, if you think about the Mariners, like Munoz was that guy. He's someone who isn't necessarily their closer, but he was their fireman. And the Blue Jays don't have anyone close to that. And maybe Nate Pearson could be that someday. And Julian Merriweather was supposed to be that. And we had dreams of Yosver Zulueta at some point. But they are lacking arms in that part of the team. Like, they have some of the front of the line starters, but they cannot develop relievers right now. Like, they have not been able to, you know, they've bought some guys who have been decent, but they haven't shopped at the top of the market. They've resisted doing that pretty much every step of the way. And it really came back to bite them in this game.
I think you made a great point there that, to me, sort of maybe underscores a bigger thing that's going on here, is the lack of development. If you look at the Rays, if you look at Seattle, as you said, the Dodgers, how many relievers have they come? Like, they've shopped at the top of the market and developed their own pitchers. I think Nate Pearson is a name that you said there that Not to put blame on Nate, not to put blame on the performance department, not to put blame on the front office, but Nate Pearson not really pitching for the last 2 years is a huge blow to this run they're supposed to be on. You talk about, man, these Mariners had these guys that throw 100 and their slider is 93. That's supposed to be Nate Pearson. That was the Nate Pearson scouting report. That is what we're supposed to have here. So I think that disappointment is real for me. It's an interesting offseason situation, not to jump all around, but the last 2 years, it was sort of easy. You go into, they have these holes, fill them with talent. They're approaching a point now where just go out and get more talent isn't as easy an answer as it was a little bit while back. I wouldn't be a good co-host if I wasn't here to pump your tires, Nick. We talked about our biggest fears last week. You said left-handed individuals in general, both internally and externally. And here we are, the biggest moment of the season. And it was a left-hander, Tim Mazza, coming out of the pen. I do want to start there. I think, you know, you made a great point when you were talking with Stoughton the other day about some of the small things that happen, like Espinal booting the first ball of the game. That costs an extra 10 pitches. Maybe if Gausman is at 80-something versus 90-something, he comes into that game. What did you think there? You talked about the full toolbox, the decision to go to Mazza. You hope almost anybody can secure a 7-run lead. What did you think there?
Yeah, I mean, at the time, I didn't like the move. That's very easy to say now, and I don't think it's controversial to say that either. There is a pitch count thing with Gausman where, like you said that I said, you know, at 80-something pitches, maybe the team gives him a little bit more rope, but with 90-something, they don't, which is odd because he just struck out the last two batters. You also think about Kevin Gausman's arsenal as a pitcher. Like, he's very much a vertically oriented pitcher. He throws the high fastballs and he throws the splitters that dive. It's not like he's a guy, you know, Jose Berríos is an example, where his pitches move very horizontally. So left-handed hitters are having everything come into them and they have a lot of success, whereas right-handers have all those pitches move away from them and it's harder for them to hit. Gausman is all up and down. Like, he does have that slider, but it's a third pitch and it's not a particularly strong third pitch, to be honest. So he isn't that guy who I feel is going to struggle against Carlos Santana. We also need to be a bit realistic about who Carlos Santana is at this point in his career. Like, he is, you know, to say washed up would be unkind. He's had some moments with the Mariners, but he's not that potent hitter that you're truly afraid of. And if it had been, I don't know, Julio Rodriguez in that moment, and you had gone to, say, Anthony Bass, who had been incredible against right-handed hitters all season long. I know Bass didn't do well in this game. But if that were the scenario, I'd be a little bit more interested in that move or inclined to give a little bit of grace, even if it didn't work out. But this move from the beginning, it seemed like John Schneider, you know, people are going to use the term overmanaging. I think that's kind of what it was. He managed as if he was determined, I'm not just going to lock down this lead. I'm not going to let the Mariners get back in this game. I'm not going to give them that shred of hope. And to be honest, I mean, you could argue whether Mays is a better pitcher than Gausman at that point. I don't think he is. I think he's struggled for the second half of the season, and turning around Santana isn't even that valuable because he's been pretty good as a right-handed hitter. But at the end of the day, you know, if you give Gausman a little bit more rope, and maybe he does give up a run there, maybe he does give up two runs there, but you also save Mazza for a time when it is a lefty in a big spot, as opposed to just using kind of your only weapon from the left side, which is, again, that's a team construction issue. Using that to turn a guy around seems like a weird move to me. Even if, say, Santana had gotten a hit against Gausman, then you can bring in Mazza because they had two lefties coming up right then. That even would make a little bit more sense to me. And there's a reason not to do that, because two batters later, you're dealing with Julio Rodriguez potentially. But again, that would be a disaster scenario, and I don't think you can necessarily manage to avoid disasters, because when you do that, sometimes disasters happen anyway.
What a mess. What a mess. I just such a not what I wanted to be doing sort of a situation with examining this. You mentioned John Schneider. You mentioned maybe overmanaging, maybe outsmarting himself. A lot of talk at the end of this game about sort of, you know, he still had the interim label as good as of a pace as he set in the regular season. His big moment here, a couple of questionable things. There's the Gausman decision. There's Tapia being in left field. A couple of balls fell in front of him. There's Romano for two innings, not having Jackie Bradley Jr. out there. Anthony Bass coming in over Jimmy Garcia. You take your pick. The house of cards began to tumble. What did you think in general? What there's a lot of moves to pick there, just threw a lot at you. Which of the moves do you think gives you the most pause and makes you most concerned? How about
I really do want to focus on process instead of results when I can, just because I think it's lazy to say this didn't work out, therefore it was a terrible decision. And that's not necessarily the case. Like, there is only so much a manager can do in terms of ensuring that the players he has execute, right? Like, he can put them in the right position, but they have to execute. So I do want to focus on the Raimel Tapia situation, because they had Jackie Bradley Jr. right there, who is a pretty good center fielder at this point, and so therefore basically an elite corner outfielder, and you're in a situation where you're protecting a big lead and you don't necessarily need a ton more offense. I mean, I guess in the end they did, but in that situation you figure that preserving a run is potentially more valuable than scoring a run, in a sense. And so you bring in Tapia, who is really, you know, an offense first player, as weird as that might be to say, because he's not some great hitter. But that's the reality. He's been a poor defender most of the season, despite the fact he theoretically has the tools. We've seen that with the Blue Jays. You know, Teoscar Hernandez theoretically has the tools to be a really good defensive outfielder. That's no guarantee that's going to happen. And Bradley, I guess it was a little bit early in the game, and you're like, oh, maybe he'll hit once or twice, and that's throwing away at bats. But I think you're kind of comfortable throwing away at a bat or two to give yourself the best possible outfielder in that situation. And they didn't do it. And there was a ball that fell in that was, Stack has said, a 55% catch probability. Well, I like my chances with Jackie Bradley Jr. to get to a ball that people catch more than half of the time. And that ended up being a really significant moment in the ballgame.
There's an even higher catch probability play coming up that we will discuss as well. We will get there, though. I do want to sort of echo your points. You know, it's easy to say, oh, how do you go to how, you know, Bass gives up the doesn't get a single out, but you got him there to be the eighth inning guy. That is literally the reason he's on the team. If you can't trust him there, you are talking about bigger problems. Did not feel confident at all in the Romano six outs. The light show is going on and the music is playing, and I'm like, this is not the time for this. I cannot handle it. Lots of worries. For me, the Gausman hook felt bad in the moment. And obviously the process and results conversation, it just sort of like, it stuck with me, and it's hard as you know, we talk about, it's a very small sample size, the smallest possible. And it's hard to now with hindsight be like, they had a 7-run lead. Why didn't they have a righty and a lefty going? It's sort of, it's easy to do that afterwards of like, it all immediately fell apart. But that felt like a situation this year where like, that was sort of David Phelps' specialty, was that sort of like, come in and limit that damage, get a ground ball, get a pop out, anything but spiking a curveball and giving up a home run. It just really stood out as, it didn't completely collapse things, but as you said, the chance to make sure that Seattle didn't get a single breath, it ended up giving them like exactly what they needed, exactly when they needed it. So that did worry me. Speaking of the 75% chance catch, in the eighth inning, this Romano is just about out of it. The blooper into center field, Bo Bichette running full speed out, George Springer running full speed in. Still chapped. I see the note where it's like, how did you feel about this play? Any moment you could think of worse. It's like, I'm still horribly scarred by this. In the moment and in hindsight, for me, this was the worst single individual play that I can remember as a Blue Jays fan. I'm sure maybe there are things that will happen that I'll be reminded of. But this was like every narrative in this season happening all at once. It was, you didn't have the bullpen depth, you avoid the situation, you had Springer getting hurt, which is a thing that happened over and over again, you had Bo being a little bit too aggressive, you had defense letting you down, you had all of it unraveling at the exact same time. It was absolute worst case scenario. We know now it was a shoulder strain and a concussion for Springer, and the moment that ball falls in and the game is tied, my sports fan fatalisticness turns over, and I was like, this game is not even going to extras. There's literally no chance they're winning this game now. Nick, am I too shaken by this, or am I correct in that this feels like about as bad as it possibly has gotten and will get?
Well, you pointed to something, which is that it fell in line with the narratives that we have heard all season. And that is part of what makes this loss so painful, in a sense, is that they lost on account of existing frailties within the team. It wasn't just a bizarre hop or, you know, a guy who doesn't normally do something. It wasn't like the backup catcher of Seattle hits a grand slam against your best pitcher and you're like, ah, well, you know, and on a good pitch. And sometimes that just happens. Like, these are existing issues with the team. Like you said, Bo's defense has been talked about a lot. Like, he is a below average defensive shortstop. I think that's fair to say. The knives are out for him a little bit more after this play than he potentially deserves. Like, it is a play missed due to aggression, due to trying to make a play, due to effort. And that's the type of mistake you would rather see than the opposite of somebody not trying or being passive or being too afraid to make the play. But baseball is not that kind of sport. Baseball is not the sport where the guy who puts in the most effort and has the most grit and wants it more wins. It is a sport of skill. And in that moment, Bichette's aggressiveness kind of screwed up the team from a skill perspective, because really that is a center fielder's ball. Absolutely. It was scary. It was scary to watch live in terms of how, you know, George Springer was going to feel. Like, it was a massive collision, and he was down for a little bit there. He was hurt really badly. George Springer is an absolute warrior too. He deserves credit. You know, he got up, he gave the fans a big wave. It's been a grind for him. Like, his whole Blue Jays career has been a grind for him. So I felt really bad for him in that moment. There's a luck component too, right? Like, a couple feet one way, it's Bichette's ball, a couple feet the other way, it's Springer's ball, and there was just enough ambiguity to let this happen. But, you know, Bichette has to own that mistake. Springer, again, he plays so hard, and he's at an age where that's going to get him in more and more trouble. And the Blue Jays, again, it's so easy to overreact and be the prisoner of the moment, but the Blue Jays do probably want to think about, is there a way to get Bo Bichette to a different position where, you know, the fact that he's kind of a defensive slight minus is hurting the team. Now, I think they kind of missed the boat on that. They could have done it with Marcus Semien. They could have done it with some of the guys who were available last offseason if they had made a big push for Francisco Lindor when he was available on the trade market. There were opportunities to bring in those huge name shortstops that Bo would have easily moved aside for, and it was early enough in his career. You know, now he's been an all-star as a shortstop. He's pretty well established, and this is something he's wanted his entire career. So, it is going to be a tricky situation with Bo going forward. On that side of the ball, he's still obviously an immensely valuable player that any team in baseball would like to have.
If you'd like to know what stage of grief I have hit with this specific play, I sort of arrived at, like, everything you said there is absolutely true. You can blame whoever you want in the situation. You can blame luck. You can blame the Springer rolling out of the way at the last second. You can blame Bo going out too far and going out too hard. You can blame Springer for not calling the ball. You can blame whatever you want, fate. However you arrive on this, you cannot change the result that ball falls in, the disaster happens. You have to live with it. You did make an interesting point there that I do want to, and maybe we'll get to a little bit later. You talked about maybe moving Bo off the position. I also come away a little bit struck as, like, maybe you want George Springer in right field as often as possible going forward. Not that he hasn't done a good job in center field, but I don't know how many times I can watch him smash into the wall and hold his arm or throw himself on the concrete to make plays. And he's been a good center fielder and is really important to this lineup, but going to be 34 at the end of next year. It becomes a luxury if he's in right field. I think he set a career high in innings in center field this year at 33, which seems impossible. I think that's another thing, and it makes for interesting offseason discussion that we will get into in just a moment. To get into the Toronto sportsness of it all, we had a lot of people, and listen, I'm of two minds. The one is, when you have success, people come on to the cheering section and they bring their other sports teams ghosts with them sometimes. But also, I feel like if the very next day you were tweeting out, you know, Raptors practice or Leafs lines, we are going to process this differently. As a Blue Jays number one way up there, I'm still stewing on this. I totally accept if your reaction to this was, well, I'll watch a different team tomorrow. I am still hunkered down on this. But regardless, it goes into the annals of epic Toronto sports collapses. Where does this rank for you? Does 8-1 compare to it was 4-1? How do you feel about it as a new corner piece for the Toronto sports disaster scale?
Let me tell you a little bit about my history with sports fandom. So I was born and raised in Toronto. I've spent the vast majority of my life living here. I also come from an English family. So my rooting interest on the soccer side has been the English national football team and West Ham. My favorite NFL team is the Seattle Seahawks, who once lost the Super Bowl by throwing an interception on the 1-yard line, despite having the most dominant physical running back in the league at that moment. So things like this happening are pretty central to my experience. I feel like I have an armor for things like this. And it's unfortunate. It's unfortunate. I would have liked to have a sports experience based on joy, based on celebrating with my friends when amazing things happen, and based on, yeah, unforgettable hugs and cheers and nights of partying. But that's not what it's been. And I don't think that's what it's been for a lot of Toronto sports fans. Like, we had the Raptors win that championship, and I don't want to take anything away from that. Like, the Raptors are huge. It also felt a little bit odd and singular. Like, there was this sort of Kawhi comet that hit Toronto, and it exploded in the most, this is a weird metaphor, so I'm going to get away from it. But, like, there was this thing that happened, and it was a strike of lightning, and it was amazing. And the way it energized the city was fantastic. I think people came to realize just how important the Raptors are to the city. But it does feel odd in the context of everything else we've seen here. And, you know, the Maple Leafs have not won the Stanley Cup in either of our lifetimes. As both of us get older, Zoobs, the faith that that will happen within our lifetimes gets less and less every single year. I would like to see it before I die, but I'm not counting on it. And that's the type of attitude you get when you're born and raised in Toronto, because misery has been the status quo. And there's something about this loss that feels believable. In a way that it might not if you were a Boston Red Sox fan or something like that. I'm just throwing one out because they've had success. I know they had plenty of failures as well. But there was something very Toronto about this, and it's unfortunate. Now, I will say the 4-1 Leafs comparison is the one that's going to get made a ton. I was listening to 32 Thoughts podcast, Sportsnet podcast with Elliot Freeman on hockey, and he said that he believed that the 4-1 was worse because the Jays had quasi recently won the World Series. I don't think I buy that necessarily, although they had the 15-16 runs, whereas the Leafs really haven't had any success in the playoffs. So there's maybe a little bit to that. What I think is that baseball is a sport without a clock, right? Until that pitch clock comes in. But even then, any comeback is technically possible in baseball. So I think part of your mind prepares yourself for that in a way that when the Leafs had that 4-1 lead with however many minutes were left on the clock, you felt like that time was going to kind of take care of itself. Whereas when you have a bullpen like this, the outs didn't take care of themselves. And so I would maybe put it slightly behind that, but I'm sure there are people who will disagree on that count.
I agree fully on the clock thing. I think that is the real one, is like, you are the Maple Leafs in that situation. It is like, we literally 10 minutes. If you can just hold on for 10 minutes, don't even have to play well. Just need to hold on and survive for 10 minutes. And the other part of it that makes baseball really unique is, you know, being able to score multiple runs at once. When you look at the 8-1 collapse, we talked about it. It's literally two plays. It's the Santana home run and it's the ball that falls in. That's seven runs, those two things, because the spiked curveball before it. Those two plays is the entire comeback. As much as obviously there are small things that get those players into those positions, you can play two plays and erase the seven runs. That is just what makes baseball unique. And as you said, there's no shortcut to closing out any lead of any size. You have to get outs. You have to continue to play well. It's part of what we love and hate when it doesn't go this way. But I do like your framing, and I'm right there with you for the most part. It's like, this is what sports is to us. It's sort of like the worst thing happening every year to a different team is sports to us. So I have it as less overall damaging to the Toronto sports psyche as 4-1, but as a Blue Jays number one guy, the collision to me is the single worst play that I've sort of had to sit there and had my eyes peeled on. But yeah, so before we move on, we'll talk about the offseason a little bit. People obviously fired up, the takes coming left, right, and center. We have gone through both of the, I think, the big ones. There's people feeling strongly about Schneider's decision-making. Did he cost himself his job? Is Bo Bichette somebody who has to move off or move to a different team or to a different position? The front office has to come under a little bit of fire with the way the team is built. They have too much fun. Take your pick. I want to know, which one of those takes do you think people, you know, with a little bit of time, cooler heads prevailing, will pass? And which one of those things may be a take that sticks around for a little bit?
I think the Schneider one is interesting, because before Ross Atkins spoke to the media, I would have told you, you know, it's kind of nonsense. Like, he did such a good job during the regular season. He kind of gave them that atmosphere shift that they were looking for after Montoyo, and the success spoke for itself. And generally speaking, he kind of liked the moves that he was making. It's kind of funny to talk about it now, but he was stretching out Jordan Romano for longer outings in hopes of the him being able to do that in the playoffs. That didn't work out, but there was some foresight there. I liked the way he deployed the lineups, generally speaking. So I would have said, oh, there's no way that they're going to get rid of Schneider just on account of this one game going poorly. And then Atkins was a little bit noncommittal about it when he spoke to the media and talked about, you know, you'd have a hard time doing better than Schneider, but he didn't quite stand behind him. I think at the end of the day, the most likely reason for that is that it seems like an odd time to say, you know what, this guy's our dude. Like, from a PR perspective, he just had a pretty bad day at the office. That's the last thing we saw, and it was extremely costly for the Blue Jays. And we're going to say, this is the guy we're going to get behind. I think longer term, as we get into the offseason, tempers go down a little bit. Like you said, ultimately, I don't think that Schneider drumbeat's going to be that big a deal. I think he will be the longer term solution. But, you know, the Bichette thing's interesting. I think he'll probably stay at shortstop, as much people don't want to see that happen. The Springer to right field thing, I could see there being more momentum for that. Like you said, you know, he played a lot in center this season, and he played quite a bit in right field in Houston. It's not something he has a problem with necessarily. He's getting older. So if they're able to find some kind of solution in center, I think that that's a storyline, or whether they're going to look for that will be a storyline to continue through the offseason.
I'll use this to sort of transition into our offseason conversation, but the Bichette one for me is pretty interesting, and I think he sort of represents the questions that are at the core of this core. Is if you're somebody that's sort of hardcore into here and say they have to replace Bichette or change something with Bichette, it's one of those things where you're not at the point in the way this team is built that you can just simply say, add a great shortstop. I mean, how many five-win 24-year-old shortstops are kicking around the league right now? It's one of those things, like, he's going to be hard to upgrade no matter what you think about his defense or what you think about his overall package. It's not he's good enough that it's really hard to just say, oh, we're going to plug in a guy that is just as good, if not better. They really hit gold last year with Marcus Semien. The move to get Matt Chapman in their most recent offseason was really big, but this is not a situation now when you go around the diamond where it looks all that easy to me to have easy answers. I mean, you even talk about the outfield. You're talking about moving George Springer to right field. Well, what of Teoscar Hernandez? What of Lourdes Gurriel Jr.? There's guys that, again, yes, they have flaws, and yes, those flaws are upgradable, but the difference in value that you're going to get for those upgrades is going to be pretty marginal. Like it's going to be hard to get a better hitter than Teoscar Hernandez. If that's the guy that you're getting out there, you're going to say, okay, we're going to get a guy who makes a few less outfield mistakes, but Teoscar Hernandez has been one of the most dangerous hitters in baseball the last 2.5 years. Gurriel, you know, for all his limitations, is somebody that has been a proven very good hitter at the major league level, warts and all. There's just not that many places in the lineup anymore where you can simply say, here's the easy upgrade. Last year, there was a couple of things, right? They didn't have a third baseman last year. They went out and got Matt Chapman. Other than, I guess, second base or an outfield slot, there's not a ton of places when you look at this on the base and say, okay, just shop at the top of the market at X position. There's internal competition. There's external competition. I think this is the most interesting offseason of this regime and this core's existence. Again, it's been very easy to say, go out and shop at the top of the outfield market. Go out and get George Springer. That's an easy thing. You say, we lost Robbie Ray. We're going to go out and shop at the high-end pitcher outlet and get Kevin Gausman to come in. Before that, it was go get Ryu because we really needed a reliable starting pitcher. And again, we need a third baseman. Go get Matt Chapman. I don't know exactly, and that he doesn't even setting aside the payroll ramifications, how much money they already have tied up. I'm not exactly sure that there's an easy answer, as there have been in years past, as to how to improve this team. Back-to-back 90-plus win seasons, 91 and 92 wins, very anyway, on its face is a success, but people are starting to get into the mode of they want to see playoff wins. 90 wins next year and a wild card again is not going to satisfy people. Nick, to first look into it, and we'll get into specifics about Stripling and some of the position stuff first of all, what's the one thing when you start to look at the offseason that you think they should start with addressing, or the big question, or the first, I don't want to say easy move, but the first move you would be looking to pursue when free agency and trading season opens here at the end of the World Series?
I mean, the reality is that the strength of this team is the position player core and the weakness is the pitching staff. So you have to look at what can you do to address that staff. What they do have is the luxury of a lot of guys under team control. But again, especially in the bullpen, a lot of those guys are more floor raisers and difference makers. The back rotation is interesting because you've got those three guys. You're presuming that Berríos is going to have a bounce back season. I think that's fair-ish to assume at this point, at least to be kind of your third starter. But then you've got, you know, you've got Mitch White, you've got Yusei Kikuchi. You're maybe you hope one of those guys is going to be the fifth starter or they can fight for it. And maybe some of the guys coming up, but realistically, you need one more starter you can count on. The bullpen, you probably need at least one high leverage arm at the, you know, you'd probably like to get more than maybe a high leverage arm and a decent lefty, something like that. And like you said, it is a difficult thing to navigate, to figure out what to do with this position player group, because it is very good. And there are not a lot of places to make that upgrade. It will be interesting after 2023 with the potential departures of Chapman and Teoscar Hernandez, then you'll start to have some holes and kind of look for those big difference makers. But the two spots, you alluded to second base. It's a bit of a tricky spot because you do have the Biggio Espinal platoon that you can roll out, and that'll work fine. If that's kind of the worst position you have on the diamond, that's okay. You could make an argument that you don't have to address that. You could leave it as is and it's okay. And then left field interests me, right? Because Lourdes Gurriel Jr. significantly less dynamic offensively than Teoscar Hernandez, arguably worse defensively as well. That whole package is, you know, he's generally been kind of an average-ish player, but I could see a scenario where they move Springer to right, move Teoscar to left, and then you look for that center fielder, but it's not an easy player to find. Just like it's not easy to find a shortstop who, like you said, is sort of a 4 or 5 win player. When we're talking about premium positions and you're trying to get a starting quality player there, those guys are difficult. Every team is looking for those guys. Even teams that are rebuilding and developing, they're hoping to find those foundational pieces. So saying we're going to head into the offseason and we're just going to find ourselves a good center fielder that makes us confident moving Springer to right is far easier said than done. Center field has been a problem for this team for quite some time now.
Yeah, when you take a look at it, I mean, not to reduce it so much, but like good center fielders are on good teams. Sort of like it's just the way that it works. You it's really hard to go knocking on a different playoff team's door and like, give me the linchpin to your defense. Give me one of your most important guys. You're going to have to pay up for that. And speaking of paying up, I think when you look at the roster, when you look at the strengths and weaknesses, the catcher situation continues to jump out. I think something that you mentioned the 2023 core, and I think this is the really important thing for me, and I mentioned it off the top a little bit with relievers, but I think it also it comes into play with position players as well. Often this front office has talked about building a sustainable winner. They want to build a team that wins not just 1 year and 2 years, but 5 years and 10 years. And the way that is done time and time again is you're able to supplement your core with both, you know, rookies and guys on entry-level deals and still in their pre-arb situations that have come up and are playing above their paychecks in those spots, and veterans like Springer, like Gosman, like the pitching staff, as we've seen. There is a question, is somebody going to jump in here? Is Moreno going to show next year that he's good enough that you can move on from maybe Kirk, maybe Jansen, who's 2 years away from free agency? Do you think, in your heart of hearts, that the three catchers they have, if we're counting Moreno here at the major league level, that's a situation that is where they deal from a strength to address this? Because, you know, again, just looking at the depth chart, just looking at the 26, 28 guys, that's the first one that jumps out with such a position that is so hard to find offensive talent. You sort of have three guys that you believe can get it done. Is that make sense as the starting point of who gets moved and where and why?
Yeah, because there's only so much at-bats at that position to go around. It's not a position. We know Moreno has a little bit of positional flexibility here, so he can play a little infield, a little outfield, but that's not what you want from him. That's not how you extract the most value from him. That's just kind of a way to play within the weird makeup of this position player group. I think that ultimately you're going to get value for one of these players. Now, Jansen is interesting because, you know, he's a veteran, he's a ready-made starter, a team can kind of set him and forget him, but at the same time, he doesn't have very much term, and he's had a ton of injuries in the last couple of years. So that's something that's going to affect his value. I think that he might have more value to the Blue Jays than other teams, just because if they buy into the power he's shown, and you know, they like him as sort of defensive catcher who's proven, the other guys are a little bit less proven on that side of the ball. I have a harder time believing he's the guy who's going to get traded, even though you could make an argument that sort of Kirk and Moreno, keep those guys together forever. Kirk is more the offense, Moreno's more the defense. That's a heck of a combination. I imagine that Jansen is the guy that they keep, just because I don't see them getting a huge return for him. Whereas Kirk, you know, you could say to someone, here's the starting American League All-Star catcher. You can build around this guy at this position. That's an easier argument to be made after the season than it was in previous years. A lot of people questioned his body type, his ability to play defense. And it's not like he's winning a Gold Glove back there, but he's shown a lot this season where I feel like his value around the league has skyrocketed. And then Moreno is a guy we know has value around the league. Like, he's been rated as a top prospect. It'd be a bit weird to move him without giving him a chance. You know, he's been a number one prospect in all of baseball, and you're going to give him away before he really establishes himself as a major league catcher. You have to be sure you're getting something significant in return. But keeping all of them is just not great asset allocation at the end of the day, because there's so few at-bats at that position to go around. And having three catchers on the roster is just not giving everyone the at-bats they deserve. Like, all three of these guys are arguably MLB starting catchers this moment. And that's a luxury that no team on the planet has. And so trading from that position of strength makes sense, but it is difficult, because all these guys have their own value that they bring to the team. And all of them have a couple of blemishes that means that you're not necessarily going to get a superstar. Like, it's so easy to be like, okay, trade Kirk and you're going to get an amazing pitcher. And then you're good to go. Like, it is kind of hard to trade catchers. It's only one spot. A lot of teams feel like they're set there. It is it's a complicated situation, but it's hard to imagine that keeping all three is the best way forward.
I do agree, especially with the point. I think Kirk is the one that is, you know, makes the most sense in terms of, if you were hypothetically, and we're not saying this is what they did, but if you were the Jays and you spent the previous offseason shopping him an awful lot, and we're like, okay, you know what, we're pulling back on these offers, we're gonna let him have a good year. He basically had the perfect year, as you said. They answered questions about the defense. He ranked out pretty good as a framer. The offense clicked. He was an all-star. He you know, hit for power when he needed to. He hit hitting streaks. I thought he showed exactly what you would, if you were to do a showcase year for Alejandro Kirk, it would look just like this. Before we move on with the Blue Jays, there is one last big question. You did say the rotation is the big question to ask going through it. A big savior for part of this year, a guy who you don't even know if they would be hosting the wild card game if they didn't have Ross Stripling every fifth day step up and go from a swingman to a dude that you were looking forward to starting, basically Aristat's number three, and a guy that probably would have started game three of the playoffs were there one. Probably going to fetch a bag this offseason. I would guess there are teams that are saying, we will pay for starting pitching, and he probably ranks up higher than we expected in the offseason ranks of available free agent pitchers. Is there any way that Ross Stripling is coming back to the Blue Jays next year to you?
I'd be surprised. I mean, Ross Atkins kind of let it slip in his media availability that it's like the Stripling spot. I forget his exact quotation, but something to the effect of that they have to address that spot. So you generally don't say that when you're going to address that spot with that guy. You know, he's earned a pretty significant paycheck. He's also a guy that has these question marks about him. He doesn't throw hard. He actually didn't elicit that low contact last year in terms of the quality of it. His main skills last year was that he just did not walk anybody. And he got guys to chase outside the zone. The changeup is really good. The slider improved as well. I don't think his stuff is necessarily as mediocre as people might believe based on what they've seen in sort of 2021 and 2020. But it's tough to justify giving him the amount of money that he's going to command, because these guys are starting to get expensive. You know, Teoscar, Vladdy in arbitration, guys are starting to hit. Like, this core the Blue Jays have, this enviable group of young players, they're not on the league minimum anymore. And it depends on what kind of payroll they run out there. They might decide it's time for a big boost, and you could justify that probably from a business standpoint. But if they stay kind of within the range they've been before, he's a hard guy to tie up so much payroll in.
I agree, and we've seen sort of with the Brios contract, with the Kikuchi contract as well, a little bit, is that the period of just being able to sort of throw the money around and not really worry about where it lands is probably behind them. They're going to have to be savvy with this offseason's moves, and it does call to mind the mention, you mentioned it earlier, I hope fans are mentally prepared for the Yusei Kikuchi trying out for a rotation spot next year, because that is coming. He is going to get the opportunity to audition for that fifth slot. Let's move on. We've poked the body enough. We have all off-season long to talk about what the Jays could do, what the Jays should do. The MLB playoffs roll on without them, like it or not. For who's left, the question is, if you're a Blue Jays fan, who should you be throwing your support behind? I will say this, and this became apparent to me in the middle of the series the Blue Jays just played, that the Toronto Blue Jays should see an awful lot of themselves in the Seattle Mariners. And I have been talking about the Mariners every time we've done this podcast. I think, and I know that for some people it can be a little hard to cheer for the team that just knocked your team out, but Blue Jays fans know how the Mariners fans feel right now. Back in 2015, the miracle run you didn't really expect, the 20-year streak broken. It feels good to come in and be that team. And I think something that Blue Jays fans have sort of hung their hat on recently is we're the likable team. We have the young stars. We have the great story. And what we saw was the Mariners are a likable team. The Mariners have young stars. The Mariners are a team that last year, just like the Blue Jays, came up one game short and used the offseason to be bold. They traded for Suarez, for Winker. In the season, they went out and got Luis Castillo. They made a bunch of moves that they needed to make to go from a team that surprised in the run last year to a team that is legitimately very good this year. So I am saying, number one on my list of teams to support, as bitter of a pill as it may be to swallow, Blue Jays fans, apologize for invading the stadium every year and support the Seattle Mariners. Am I crazy?
So I have a full list here. You know, people like a power rankings. I'm calling it the playoff likability index. I have the Mariners here at number four. And I agree with a lot of what you said. It's an up-and-coming team. They've broken a curse. You know, Julio Rodriguez is a really fun star. Luis Castillo, fantastic against the Blue Jays. Curious to see what he does further in the playoffs. My team at number one, or maybe, I don't know. We'll just go to number one here. We're not going to read the whole list, but spoiler alert, the Yankees are at the bottom, as are the Astros and the Dodgers. I don't think anyone really wants to see these juggernauts continue to win. I have the Philadelphia Phillies in here. Just kind of, they got no business being here. Like, they're significantly worse from a raw talent perspective than any other team around them in the National League. We were all pretty surprised they knocked off the Cardinals. I think most people kind of assumed the Cardinals would go through there. They also have, you know, the Blue Jays fans have always liked the big boy factor. They've liked the Rowdy Tellezes that have rolled through town, the Vladdies, the Alejandro Kirk. And now, you know, the Phillies are taking up the mantle with the Kyle Schwarber, Nick Castellanos, you know, Rhys Hoskins. Like, they're sticking guys who can't play any defense all over the defensive outfield. And it's kind of a mess out there, but it's fun. They're just trying to win with pure slugging. I'm not sure it's going to work, but I always like to see teams in the playoffs who are doing something different from what the other teams are doing. They're kind of doing it different by necessity because that's the best guys they've got. But they've got some great pitching talent, too, at the top of the rotation. Zach Wheeler is always really fun to watch. Like, I don't necessarily think they're going to pull an upset here. They're going to make a deep run, but it's always fun to go with the underdogs. I don't think anyone's a bigger underdog than Philadelphia in a sense, even though they won that first game of the NLDS. And I just think it's kind of a goofy style they've got going there with all the sluggers. I also have a soft spot in my heart for Bryce Harper because, you know, it's just been a long, weird road with him from supposed phenom, like next guy, and then losing that title to Trout, and then, you know, leaving the Nationals before they have that success, and then winning the MVP with the Phillies. I don't know. His career has been fascinating to me, and he's someone that I find myself pulling for a little bit, even if he, you know, it was a bit abrasive early in his career.
I'm right there with you. With a desire to, you want to see great players do great things. It's sort of, I'm very simple in that way. I had Phillies number two for similar reasons to you, and I think it'll come into my other picks as well, is I love that they sort of fly in the face of conventional wisdom. It's very much, we just saw with the Blue Jays, it's like, if you want to win in the playoffs, got to have a reliable bullpen, got to have good defense. And the Phillies are like, Do you? Like, are you sure? You sure you can't just have DHs play four positions? I think it's hilarious. I love Kyle Schwarber. You talked about the big fella sort of situation. I think, you know, it's fun. You get a lineup that the first five guys are all trying to hit home runs every swing. I think that's awesome. And I think just sort of the way that they fly in the face of conventional wisdom of what we've learned is really important. Another team I want to touch on, I have the Cleveland Guardians, I have them third. I think it would be a nice story, similar to when Tampa Bay dropped the devil from their name. We've begged Cleveland for so long, changed the name, its offensive name. They do it. They immediately have success. I think this is a team that has great pitching. They just continue to find pitchers out of nowhere. They get perhaps rightfully shaken off a little bit playing in the Central. The Cleveland's 92 wins doesn't feel like the Jays' 92 wins. And I think there was in the offseason, I remember there was sort of this idea. It was like, oh, the Jays are going to trade for Jose Ramirez or that he's going to be on the block. And it's like, why would the Guardians trade Jose Ramirez? He likes it there. They're a 92-win team. They don't strike out all that much. They sort of a different style. I think that different stylistic, as much as it's great to have a team that, you know, maximizes everything and it's completely put together properly, there's properly, I use in quotation marks, is sort of like the way that conventional wisdom tells you to build a team. But, you know, a team that puts the ball in play, a team that plays good defense, pitches well, sort of the exact opposite of the Phillies, as a matter of sort of hilariously, now that I hear my two picks back to back. But I sort of, they're really intriguing in that it's not obvious when you look at them what makes them successful. But you have Andrés Giménez maybe having the least predictable 6-win season I've ever seen. Steven Kwan is a guy that puts the bat on the ball all the time and it really can be a problem in the playoffs. And I think, you know, we talk about the unpredictability and the randomness of playoff baseball. And the game has gone so far into trying to minimize randomness as much as possible, right? Strikeouts are a thing that you reliably know what's going to happen. If you can get a bunch of strikeouts, you know that those are outs. And the Cleveland sort of thrives on the like, okay, what if we took that away from you, though? What if we took away all these strikeouts and just put the ball in play and see what happens and make things happen? I think Josh Naylor also is an easy guy to cheer for, a guy who gets fired up, a Canadian guy, if you're into that sort of thing. I think he's had some great moments this year and a ton of fun to follow, a guy who gets fired up. Luke Maley, don't overlook the Luke Maley of it all. So I'm pulling for the Guardians as well. And then again, I think it's safe to say Astros, Dodgers, Yankees at the bottom, and a bit of a soft spot for the Padres, but I'll let you sort of expound on that.
Yeah, I had the Guardians at number five. I think you're absolutely right on the name factor. It is good to see them kind of karmically rewarded for dropping that super offensive name. I also kind of like the Guardians name. It is sort of silly and different, and also it pertains to a real Cleveland thing. I think they could have done a lot worse. You know, I think about the Washington Commanders in the NFL and how kind of that team is not getting a lot of love right now. I think you made great points about the way that they're stylistically different. Jose Ramirez probably still deserves more credit just as a player. You know, he's a constant top five, top three MVP type of candidate. It never seems like he has that one monster year, but it's partly just because he's good at everything as opposed to being that guy who has that one characteristic that stands above all the rest. Like, he's a great base stealer. He's a great defender. He's got good power, patience. He just has it all. He's fun to watch. I had them further down in part because the AL Central factor, and partly just because I don't love rewarding teams I feel like don't spend money. Like, I feel like the Cleveland has been cashing those revenue sharing checks a little bit, in part because they know that the AL Central is weak and they can make some noise without kind of investing in the roster the way that other teams have to do. So I penalize them pretty heavily for that. I had the Padres as number two, actually. It's just fun to see them stand up to the Dodgers. Like, they have a bit of a Sisyphean task on their hands in terms of dealing with the Dodgers in the NL West every year, and they have tackled it head on. Like, they've spent a ton of money. They made aggressive trades over and over again to get the star-studded roster, and the Fernando Tatis Jr. thing it's a real shame, and he would be missed in this series. I think as a figure, he would bring the talent gap closer, and he's just a fun guy to watch. But, you know, they got Juan Soto still. They've got really great starting pitching. I would still be inclined to believe the Dodgers are going to take them out, but they're bringing the fight to a team that it would be easy. A lot of teams in their scenario where they could say, oh, we're a small market and the Dodgers are so good, and we're just going to do like the 18-year rebuild where we keep trying to maximize young players. They say, no, young players are an avenue for us to get star players. And that's what they've done for the last couple of years. And I really appreciate that.
Excellent points. And I agree. An easy team to cheer for in the Padres. Tatis missing aside, there is, of course, the opportunity to cash in on these picks. We've gone through who we like emotionally, time to put a little bit of money where the mouth is. You can find incredible markets and make your World Series pick on North Star Bets. You can also find Nick's excellent work. He gives you insights for every game, all kinds of stuff you can find there. And we are going to take a look at the World Series futures as they creep up ever so closer on the Run Line. All right, Nick, it is time to take a look at the World Series futures. I do almost terrified to mention some of the picks that I made last week. I think I was heavy on the Cardinals. I think I was heavy on the Blue Jays. Like sand through my fingers, they go away. Of course, North Star Bets, a great place to make your World Series future bets. You can find Nick's insights all over that site, always taking a great view of the matchups and giving you all the details you need to place your wagers. Nick, looking at the lines for World Series favorites, the wheat has been separated from the chaff. We have the knowing who is through, the wild card. What do you see here on the board that intrigues you now that things have changed?
Well, before the playoffs, I was really adamant about the kind of pick one favorite and pick one long shot. Right now, I think the favorite's value has gone down significantly. Like right now, we have the Astros at plus 250 as we record, Dodgers at plus 265, which is interesting because really all we've seen is wildcard teams get eliminated and they weren't going to have to deal with those teams anyway. And I don't think that, I guess the Mets have come out of the NL. They might have been considered a threat. The Cardinals. So you could make an argument that the Dodgers are a decent bet right now, but the value has come down. I think that that's a bet you would have liked to have made a while ago because there was never any indication the Dodgers were going anywhere. I don't know if now is the right time to jump in. The Astros, haven't lost an ALDS game as we record here. So that's maybe you feel a little bit more comfortable that they're going to go through. Sometimes when you're looking at this part of the playoffs and everything is moving a ton every single day, like when the Braves went down one game in the NLDS, they went to plus 750, which I thought was a really interesting value. If you believe in them against the Phillies, which is, even with a one game lead, you don't necessarily think Philadelphia is going to close that out. I would look for opportunities like that. As I look at the board right now, I'm interested in the Padres at plus 1,000. They've tied up the NLDS. Anything can happen in that three-game series. If they knock off the Dodgers, not only are the Cardinals and Mets already gone, those are two heavy hitters. You've also potentially, you get rid of the Dodgers themselves, who are arguably the best team in baseball. And if they're able to do that, who can't they beat? So that's one number that jumps off the screen to me. The Guardian Mariners are a little bit further down at this point. I don't think I would mess around with them. I'm looking at the middle of the board. I'm looking at the Braves at plus 500. I'm looking at the Padres at plus 1,000. Those are the two teams that jump out at this moment.
Braves plus 500, could not agree more, was heavy on them last week. The one that I was heavy on didn't immediately fall flat on their faces. I think we saw, obviously, last year winning the World Series lets you know they're a good enough World Series team, and they came on strong and have everything you really like, and they've locked up their core. These are the guys. This is going to get used to it. We grew up in the 90s with the Braves being a part of this conversation every year. We're back to that. This core that has won and will continue to win is sticking around, and I think an opportunity here to see what could be the beginning of a really ruling the National League in the way that the Dodgers did in the NL West for the last decade plus. So I like Braves plus 500 and all the things you said about the value changing on the favorites aside. I'm ready to swallow my pride here and just say, I'll just take Astros 250. That's life. I'm fine. you win world. Astros 250, eat at Arby's. Absolutely. Why not? Absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, the Astros have such a clean run here. Potentially they had that amazing game one victory over the Mariners where maybe things could have gone in a direction where they're in a hole and the Mariners had Castillo coming up. You could have envisioned a very different scenario where they're back on their back foot. At this point, it looks like they're in control of that series. And then, and we've talked about this before, there's so many good teams in the NL. The Mets and Cardinals are gone. The Braves are still really good. The Dodgers are still really good. On the AL, I don't feel the same way. So the Astros, not only are they going to be favored in this series, I think they'd be pretty heavily favored against the Yankees and extremely heavily favored against the Guardians. I feel very good about their chance to be in the World Series. So at plus 250, and you got a team that you feel good about their chances to be in the World Series, that is an appealing bet. I am just inclined to believe that the winner of the World Series comes from the National League this year, but maybe that's just more of a feeling.
I don't think that's too far off at all. As always, you can find those lines at North Star Bets along with Nick's excellent work. You can also get the markets on every single game, player props, single game parlays, you name it. You can find it there. It is an excellent place to find some action. Nick, boy, hopefully this is the nadir. Hopefully this is as bad as we feel. We have lots more, of course, to come as the World Series inches closer and then into the offseason. Cannot wait. I have been Andrew Zuber from The Parlay. Nick Ashburn from North Star Bets has been my co-host. Thank you so much. You know the drill. Like, subscribe, review, rate, whatever you can do in your podcast catcher. It does tons for our self-esteem and for the ranking of the show. So we appreciate it. Until next time, thank you for listening to Pitch Talks.
Pitch Talks, brought to you by North Star Bets. That's a win.